This is the first day of this November 2009 seven-day session, and we'll begin by reading, commenting on the teachings of the 20th century Chan master Xu Yun. That's spelled H-S-U-Y-U-N, and those U's are pronounced pretty much like the German U-Umlaut, Xu Yun. I don't have any biographical material on Xu Yun other than an entire book about him, so I don't have much to read. He died at the age of 120 in the 20th century, so somewhere in the middle of the 20th century, 1950, 1960. No, it would have been later than that, because he got swept up in the Cultural Revolution, which ended in 76. So maybe it was the late 60s or early 70s, 1960s, 70s. Roshi Kaplow read from this book a few times in Sesshin Teishos. And when I went to China, one of my pilgrimages, it seemed that almost anyone I met who knew anything about Zen would announce proudly that he was a disciple of Xu Yun. Their idea of I think they said student of Xu Yun, their idea of a student later realized was from more of a distance, that they may not have ever met him, but that they considered him a guide from his books, his writings. But he is probably the most illustrious and the most famous of the Chan masters of the 20th century. So I'll just go into this old book. This is old, relatively speaking. It was one of the first books translated into, first books on Zen translated into English. This was in 1960. And it's called Chan and Zen Teaching, Series 1. And it's edited, translated, and explained by Charles Luk, L-U-K. Chan and Zen, Chan, of course, is just the Chinese word for Zen, or vice versa. Chan came first. What we call Zen originated as Chan in China, and then the Japanese used the word Zen, which has become the norm in the West, is to use Zen instead of Chan. Oh, he considers himself, Charles Luk, the editor and translator, considers Xu Yun his own master. Okay, here's a little bit that I missed right here in the foreword to the book. Luk says, that Xu Yun was born in 1840, his mother died immediately after his birth. At the age of 11, two little girls were selected for his wives, but were later converted to Buddhism by their nominal husband, that is Xu Yun. After his father's death, the two young ladies entered a nunnery and became later two enlightened nuns. At 13, he already thought of leaving home. Leaving home, of course, is just the phrase meaning to become a monk, a celibate monk. He already thought of leaving home, but was prevented by his father. When he was 19, with a cousin, he ran away from his house and entered Kushan Monastery. When he was 28, he went to stay in a cave for 3 years. When he was 30, he left the cave and wandered from place to place seeking teaching. He was taught how to practice with a koan. The koan he took, his first koan was, "Who is dragging this corpse here?" When he was 43, he went to Puto, which is near Shanghai on the east coast of China. It's considered one of the five sacred mountains of China. It was one of the places I went on my pilgrimage. It's very strange to be at such a big monastery that overlooks a beach. You could look out from the monastery and see people on the beach. It seemed at the time that no one was in the water, even though this was August, plenty hot. And we got the feeling that the Chinese at that time didn't much care to go swimming. When he was headed there, when he's going to this Puto, he was caught in a heavy snowstorm and became gravely ill and was twice saved by a beggar who gave him food. During his conversation with the beggar asked him some strange questions. At that time, the master was still unenlightened. So let's do a little arithmetic here. He was 43 at this time, and he became a monk at 19, so 24 years, more or less. He'd been practicing for 24 years without having come to awakening. After after Puto Shan, he traveled west and went to Lhasa, Tibet, and went on to Bhutan, India, Sri Lanka, and Burma before returning to China, where he rebuilt many monasteries. He later traveled to Malaysia, and Thailand. It doesn't say anything about his enlightenment here. It says he was the Dharma successor to all the five Chan sects of China. It says the number of his followers is very great and cannot be counted. One other thing not mentioned here. And remember, there's an entire book, a biography of Xu Yun with an enormous number of details. But one thing not mentioned here, of many things, was that he fell out of favor during the Cultural Revolution when the Red Guards were on a rampage through China and suffered quite a bit of physical abuse at their hands. He did survive that, but was never quite the same. So the name of this chapter that the editor gives is Prerequisites of Chan Training. this first sentence says it all. And this is, of course, the Shu Yun teaching. The object of Chan training is to realize the mind for the perception of self-nature, that is, to wipe out the impurities which soil the mind so that the fundamental face of self-nature can really be perceived. Wipe out the impurities really means to see through our delusions, our thoughts and confusion, to see through these things. It's the seeing through that really comes down to wiping out. When we truly see through our delusions, then they are really not ever again the same. He goes on, impurities are our false thinking and clinging to things as real. Self-nature, which of course is also referred to as Buddha nature, true mind, true nature, self, and essential nature. Self-nature is the meritorious characteristic of the Tathagata wisdom, which is the same in both Buddhas and sentient beings. Sentient beings is just the standard way in China, the standard translation of so-called unenlightened people, sentient beings. And there's this distinction that is often used in Chan texts, the distinction between Buddhas and sentient beings, or between enlightened and unenlightened beings. Here he reminds us this Buddha nature, this true nature of ours, is the same whether we're enlightened or not, whether we've realized our intrinsically enlightened nature or not. If one's false thinking and grasping are cast aside, one will bear witness to the meritorious characteristic of one's Tathagata wisdom and will become a Buddha. Otherwise, one will remain a sentient being. For since countless eons, our own delusion has immersed us in the sea of birth and death. Since our defilements have already lasted so long, we are unable instantly to free ourselves from false thinking in order to perceive our self-nature. This is why we must undergo Chan training. The prerequisite of this training is the eradication of false thinking. As to how to wipe it out, we have already many sayings of Shakyamuni Buddha, and nothing is more simple than the word halt in his saying, "If it halts, it is enlightenment." Now, this is the first time I've ever heard the word halt in a Zen text. It's fine. It makes sense. What it really means is, the translator, has a footnote here. He says the full sentence is, and here's the full sentence: the mad mind does not halt. If it halts, it is bodhi, that is, enlightenment. So in that sentence, we have both the condition of the ordinary person's mind, that is, the turmoil, the tumult of the worrying of thoughts in the mind, and that if we could bring this mind to stillness, then that right there is our enlightened nature. Stillness here doesn't mean somehow withdrawing into a closet or a cave or something where there's no sound. Stillness really means that there is sound, there is ordinary sounds all around us maybe, but we're not attaching to the sounds. We're not clinging to the sounds. And in that non-clinging, non-attachment, there is a kind of stillness or silence that is beyond this conventional dichotomy of sound versus silence. So again, since our mental defilements have lasted so long, he says, we are unable to free ourselves from false thinking instantly. This is what we have confirmed for us in Sesshin, where despite our most strenuous efforts, the mind, for the longest time, it seems, the mind will not settle. And this is because of habit force, because of our long habit, our whole life, of trafficking in thoughts, and not just this life, but lives, innumerable lives before this life. We've developed such a habit force of playing with our thoughts and fantasies that they won't easily be brought to stillness. He goes on, the Chan sect, from its introduction by Bodhidharma after his arrival in the East until after the passing of the sixth patriarch, spread widely all over the country and enjoyed great prosperity. He's talking about a couple hundred years, the first couple hundred years of what we call Zen or Chan. Enjoyed great prosperity unknown before and after that period. However, the most important thing taught by Bodhidharma and the sixth patriarch was only this. And then he quotes, expel all concurrent causes, do not give rise to a single thought. To expel all concurrent causes is to lay them down. And then there's a footnote where the translator says, in Chan terminology, to lay down causes or thoughts is to lay down the heavy load of causes or thoughts to free the mind from defilement. Thoughts are causes. It's by trafficking in thoughts that we cause this wheel of life and death to go on revolving, in which we're trapped between desire and aversion, likes and dislikes. Every time we choose to dwell in our thoughts, we are giving a shove to this karmic momentum that we're caught in of our thoughts. So what we want to do, of course, in practice, is to lay them down. Leave them alone, that means. Don't engage with thoughts. Therefore, he says, these two sentences expel all concurrent causes, do not give rise to a single thought, are the prerequisites of Chan training. If these two sentences are not put into actual practice, not only will the training be ineffective, but also it will be impossible to start it, for in the midst of causes which rise and fall, thought after thought, how can you talk about Chan training? Well, I'm sure that if Xu Yun were asked about this, he wouldn't say it's a black or white, you know, all or nothing thing. We all in our early in our practice, and sometimes for years and years after that, we struggle. We struggle with these thoughts. We can't just lay them down like that. Although we could. Theoretically, we could just leave them alone, but it's extraordinarily rare to be able to do that. And so it takes time for most of us. It takes a great deal of time to learn that we don't want to go there. We don't want to be involved with our thoughts because nothing good can come from it. Zen Master Dogen talked about practice as a process of continuous failure, in which we try to stay with the breath or the koan, and the mind slips away into thoughts and fantasies, and then we bring it back and we try again, and it slips away and it keeps slipping away. Well. That's practice. That's practice. Resetting, resetting, resetting. He goes on. Now we know that the sentences expel all concurrent causes, do not give rise to a single thought, are the prerequisites of Chan training. So how can we fulfill these prerequisites? Those of high spirituality are able to halt forever the arising of a single thought until they reach the state of birthlessness and will thereby instantaneously realize enlightenment without any more ado. This would be... One practitioner in a million. Those of lower spirituality will deduce the underlying principle from facts and will thoroughly understand that the self nature is fundamentally pure and clean, and that distress and enlightenment, as well as birth, death, and nirvana, are all empty names having no connection whatever with self nature. Now, there's a lot packed in here, so let's unpack it. Those of lower spirituality, which means almost everyone, will deduce the underlying principle from facts. And we have footnotes here to help us through this rather dense prose. The underlying principle would mean the basic ground of mind. And facts would be the world of phenomena. So, what we live in a world of phenomena, every kind of phenomena, and we have the possibility of intuiting or realizing that which is from the world, our world of phenomena, we have the possibility of of realizing that which is beyond phenomena. Once we do that, he says, they will thoroughly understand that this self-nature is fundamentally pure and clean. Let's just stop there for a minute. It's fundamentally pure and clean. This points to the absolutely radical nature of the Dharma, that all beings, just as they are, have this pure, bright Buddha mind, just as they are. It's not that we have these defiled minds and then if only we could get to this point in the future where our minds are pure. No, already, now, everyone here, everyone in this Zendo is in their true nature, in their fundamental nature, is absolutely perfect, lustrous, bright, pure. And then what we call, he goes on, that what we call distress or defilements, as well as enlightenment, and these words, birth, death, nirvana, samsara, are all empty names, having no connection whatever with self-nature. That is, we can use this vocabulary, we can talk about these dichotomies of enlightenment and ignorance, birth, death, nirvana, past, present, future, but they're just constructs. They're just assemblages of letters that we've put together to refer to things. But really, in the midst of all these words and ideas, there is only this enlightened nature. There's nothing but enlightened nature. He goes on, that phenomena, always remember, phenomena means everything physical and everything mental, everything we can conceive of is a phenomenon from a Buddhist perspective. That phenomena are like a dream, an illusion, a bubble, and a shadow. That is, they have no permanent, fixed nature to them. In other words, all phenomena, physical and mental, are in flux. Well, we can see this so clearly in our thoughts and the mental phenomena that traipse through the mind every time we do zazen. We see the flux. But it's also true of the physical phenomena, that this that seems so solid is, in fact, energy in flux. It just deceives us into thinking that it's solid, that it's not in flux. And that the four basic elements constituting the physical body, that is fire, earth, air, and water, this is standard way of referring to all physical phenomena composed of these four elements, as well as mountains, rivers, and the great earth, which are within self-nature, are just like bubbles in the sea. Again, flux. Bubbles are a very common analogy in Buddhist texts to show this quality of flux. These phenomena rise and fall, following one another in succession, without interfering with the essence of self-nature. Therefore, one should not follow illusion in its creation, stay, change, and annihilation. This is the four These four words refer to the nature of all things. There's what he says is creation or arising. Stay means just this the life of anything, animate or inanimate. Change is often translated as the decay or the deterioration. And the fourth is annihilation, the disappearance. In other words, not get caught up in the arising of things, in the duration of things, the deterioration of things, and then the passing away of things. But instead give rise to feelings of joy, sadness, attachment, and rejection. These are the most common reactions we have to these four processes of birth, duration, deterioration or decay, and annihilation, passing away. So let's just get out of these thicket of words and or conceptual words and just consider the body, our own physical body. That like all phenomena, our body comes into being, we're born. It lasts a shorter or longer period of time. It decays. We see this, the weakening and deterioration of the body and the mind, the memory, and our mental agility and acuity. That deteriorates, that decays, and then eventually we die. And not to get caught up in that illusion, because underneath that change, that flux, there is something beyond change. And that is what we call our self nature. If we do get attached to, let's stick with this example, the body, then we can go through these, we're vulnerable to joy, a kind of giddy joy when everything is going well. In our youth, let's say, with great health and vitality, beauty, strength. And then to the degree that we get attached to all those wonderful things, then we will experience sadness when these things pass. He goes on, one should lay down everything with which one's body is burdened, thus becoming exactly like a dead person. Here he's referring to a deep state of absorption where we reach a detachment that is sometimes in the text likened to being dead. This is not something anyone needs to worry about. It's when we are to be dead in this context, to be like a dead person means to be beyond anxiety, beyond fear, beyond distress or anguish. He goes on, the outcome will be that sense organs, sense data, and consciousness will vanish, and the greed, anger, and delusion will be eliminated. This triad of sense organs, sense data, and consciousness can be understood as any. Well, the sense organs is, you know, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, brain. The sense data are the sounds, sights, smells, tastes, and so forth. And consciousness is the sensing, the hearing. These are sometimes called the three wheels for some reason. The three wheels, and the person who is seeing, the sight and the act of seeing. In other words, subject, object, and the process of perceiving. That these will vanish. In other words, that we lose disconnection, like the subject and object. That distinction just merges. And that these three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion, will be eliminated. And then he says, when all our feelings of joy and sadness, of cold, of hunger and the warmth of one's fill, of honor and dishonor, of birth and death, of happiness and misery, of blessing and calamity, of praise and censure, of gain and loss, of safety and danger, and of handicap and help, when these are all cast aside, all these feelings, this is the true laying down of everything. To lay down a thing is to lay down everything forever, and this is called the laying down of all concurrent causes. This is freedom. This is a state of great freedom, getting beyond all of these dualistic feelings and reactions. When all concurrent causes have been laid down, false thinking will vanish with the non-arising of differentiation and the elimination of all attachments. When one reaches this state of the non-arising of a single thought, the brightness of self-nature will appear in full. Then only can the prerequisites of Chan training be entirely fulfilled. Entirely fulfilled. Then only can the further efforts in the true training and real introspection will be required if one wishes to be qualified for realizing the mind for the perception of self-nature. I'm remembering why I don't read from this text more often. This is dense, long sentences, which are more in more the standard kind of prose in 1960. Now, readers need paragraphs of one or two sentences in order to be coaxed to keep reading. Well, there's another 6-inch paragraph here, so rather than get into that, let's stop for now and we'll resume with this tomorrow. Recite the four vows.